from the classroom to the emergency room, OR and beyond. You're joining Trauma ICU Rounds with your host, Dr. Dennis Kim.
Welcome back to Trauma ICU Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Dennis Kim, and after a three-week hiatus in British Columbia, Canada, two of which were spent in quarantine, despite the raging COVID pandemic here in Los Angeles County, I have to say that it's nice to be back at Harbor and in the trenches with my amazing colleagues, friends, and staff, all of whom show up every day to take care of those in need. This includes our amazing housekeepers in the trauma surgical ICU like Edna and Maria, to our nurses on the front line like Miss Manjit, who reminded me this week that I should probably be playing less video games and putting out more podcast and medical education content. So thanks for that reminder, Manjit. With that said, I'm really excited for our guest this week. Joining us on Rounds is Dr. Walt Biffle. Dr. Biffle is the Medical Trauma Director of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery, as well as the Paul N. Whittier Chair of Trauma at Scripps Memorial Hospital, La Jolla, in La Jolla, California. Dr. Biffle completed his medical school education at the George Washington University School of Medicine and his residency at the University of Colorado Health Sciences Center in Denver, Colorado, where he also spent quite a bit of time as a faculty member. Walt is the recipient of numerous research honors, awards, and investigator-initiated grants. He serves on the editorial boards of several key surgical journals, and he's currently the co-editor-in-chief of the World Journal of Emergency Surgery. Side note, I gotta say, I love the guidelines that that journal puts out, as well as the reviews of the literature. And like so many of our guests, Dr. Biffle holds numerous leadership and administrative positions, both regionally, nationally, and internationally. Walt has published over 315 peer-reviewed scientific papers and 75 book chapters, and for those of you who have ever looked into the topic of blunt cerebral vascular injury or BCVI, I'm sure you've stumbled across several of Dr. Biffle's publications on this very topic. I recently had an opportunity to catch up with Dr. Biffle and talk all things BCVI. Let's take a listen. Maybe for the young researchers out there, how did you initially stumble across this topic? And then how did it blossom from there?
Oh, that's a good question. So, I guess I was in the right place at the right time is a short answer to that. You know, historically, and when I was an intern in 1990, that's when I saw my first case of it. Patient on our service went to make rounds and he had a hemiparesis. And I called the chief resident. He says, oh no, he has a carotid injury. And at the time, that's what was in the textbooks. How do you diagnose a blunt carotid injury? Well, they had a stroke. Yikes. And all the literature at that point in time, it was the same. They were diagnosed after they demonstrated an ischemic neurologic deficit. And the incidence of the injuries at that point in time, there were at least four multicenter trials. It was 1 in 1,000 trauma admissions. Fortunately for me, if you're interested in something, you got to have it to study it. The group, Gene Moore and his brother Fred at Denver General, were part of a Western Trauma Multicenter study. And one of the conclusions from that study is these injuries are out there and we're not diagnosing them early enough. So a couple years later, in the system between our university hospital and Denver General, there was a big study looking at the diagnosis of torn aortas. You know, at the time, this was early 90s, mid 90s, you had to do an aortogram to rule out a torn aorta. So there was a big study looking at CT, helical CT versus aortography. So everybody was getting both. And this went on for a couple years. And during that time, they started adding on carotid arteriograms and studied about 170 patients and found 6 injuries. And it's like, wow, that's a lot more than 1 in 1,000. And so that study finished up in 1996, around the same time that Fabian's seminal paper from Memphis was published. They reported almost a 0.7% incidence of carotid injuries. So we started screening at that point. This was 1996, so that was my chief resident year. And a little more than a year later, a junior attending, Gene Moore said, well, we should write this up. We've been finding a lot of these injuries. So again, right place at the right time.
Sure.
Sent the abstract to the American Surgical. It's the only paper I've ever gotten on there. Called the unrecognized epidemic of lung carotid injuries. And we had found an incidence almost 1% of the trauma patients. And the important thing there was where Fabian's study from Memphis, they were almost all symptomatic patients. They were just looking harder. Ours were mostly asymptomatic, and that really set it up for screening. You know, Fabian's group had shown you could improve neurologic outcomes with treatment, and we were showing you could find a lot of them. And so that's how screening took off, and it just built from there.
Yeah, and so Memphis and Denver, I mean, those are the two centers that we always hear about. And you did talk about or mention screening, and obviously screening criteria have been crucial in terms of identifying patients at risk. When we look at the Western Trauma Association guidelines, or we just look at the guidelines between the two centers, there are some subtle differences. Any thoughts in terms of, how should I put it, maybe superiority of one versus the other, or are they more complementary?
Well, if I can go off on another historical tangent.
Absolutely.
The whole idea of screening, it was heretical when we presented this. And I remember at the American Surgical hearing the conversations from, you know, very renowned trauma surgeons saying, are these guys crazy giving heparin to trauma patients? What are you talking about? And then the fact that we're using aortography or arteriography to diagnose them, that was something else. But screening, it was a difficult buy-in. And when we started doing this in Denver, we would get a lot of patients transferred from the mountains. And we had an outreach program. We would take call in Aspen and Vail and Steamboat. So these surgeons would call and say, wow, you know, I got this guy, he crashed his car, his face is smashed. Do we really need to transfer him to Denver for an arteriogram? And so we did a study looking at the highest, you know, trying to figure out what are the high risk criteria, looking at every injury pattern, the, you know, did they fracture their mandible, their nose, their orbit, their, was it a Lafort fracture? What was the GCS? Putting this all in an Excel spreadsheet myself, there's no shortcut. And we had about 250 patients and we came up with these high risk criteria, the GCS less than 6. Of course, not everyone with a GCS less than 6. Anyway, they were debated Lafort fractures and
sure.
And so on. And so we said, okay, these are the high-risk criteria, but 20% of the patients had none of these. So what do you do? And if you look over the years, back to the point about screening criteria, everyone who's published them, there are holes there. There are a lot of patients right. who are missed. And about 10 years ago, someone presented at AAST a National Trauma Databank study, and they said you would have to screen an unrealistic 96% of the population to get every injury. Here we are. So the screening criteria, we try to get the highest risk. And I can't say that one's superior to the other. The one thing that's become clear over the years is the more you look, the more you'll find.
Right, right. Yeah, like so many things, whether it's VTE and definitely in the case of BCVI. Now, I guess back then, like you mentioned, these are pretty invasive studies. I mean, we're doing invasive arteriography or four-vessel digital subtraction angiography to look for these injuries, whereas these days, we've got, you know, 256 slice scanners. It's non-invasive. The resolution is incredible. And so when we think about these high-risk criteria, is it more applicable back 10, 20 years ago than it is today? And should we just be screening 96% or 100% of all blunt polytrauma patients?
Well, that's a great question and something that I think you got at with your East Practice Management yeah. Guideline paper. My bias has always been that if we had a good, reliable, non-invasive test, we should use it and screen more rather than less. So yes, the high-risk criteria was important when you're talking about sending a patient from Aspen to Denver in the winter for an arteriogram. That's a risky situation.
Right.
Versus they're getting a CT of everything else, add on the CTA. And as you know, there have been two recent papers presented on this. One is in publication, the other just presented at AAST and doing universal screening. And the one from Virginia Commonwealth, they reported an incidence of, I think it was 2.7% in their population screening everybody. The Birmingham paper that was just presented, 7.5% of their patients had injuries. It's remarkable. It raises some questions in and of itself. But, you know, again, if you have a patient population that's loaded with high energy mechanisms, I think screening more liberally is reasonable. And as you pointed out in the East paper, patients would want to not have a stroke. And the risk of a CTA, you're already giving them contrast. If you can build it into the protocol, you know, the radiation addition, you're already CTing the cervical spine. So I think it's a low-risk proposition to screen more liberally.
And when it comes to screening criteria, it seems like as the years have gone by, the criteria have expanded. And so it used to be maybe just a handful of things that you could potentially remember or memorize. But it's gotten to the point where I feel like there's just so many different criteria. So in order to sort of simplify it, so we have a blunt polytrauma patient, we're potentially concerned about BCVI. Is there a broader way of thinking about who should or shouldn't be screened? Or should we just have a snapshot of this on our phone? And then every time we get a blunt polytrauma patient, we look and see if there's a, you know, one of the criteria that are met.
Yeah, that's always been a great question and asked by many people at the meetings. And I think, you know, the pathophysiology of this is primarily a hyperextension of the neck. And so if you think about it that way, I think anyone who gets thrown over the handlebars of a bicycle or a motorcycle, they're in the category. So that's a high risk thing. A high speed rollover in the car would be another one. Where it gets harder is, you know, the falls. There is some literature on geriatric patients who fall. Well, you know, they've got degenerative disease of the neck, and talk about more liberally CTing their neck even when they have a normal exam. That's a harder one, but I think that the, you know, hyperextension of the neck, a direct blow to the neck, those are two kind of no-brainers. If there's a cervical spine injury, then yes. Beyond that, then you start getting into the one-offs, or not necessarily the one-offs, but you see as the Denver criteria have grown, a patient with a concussion and upper rib fractures, or a blunt cardiac injury, you know, these kind of things.
Severe thoracic trauma.
Yeah. And, you know, one of my early cases, a girl who had a femur fracture and a rib fracture and was out on the ward. This is it when I was at Brown, and she woke up with a stroke the next morning. Nobody would have ever thought to screen her, certainly not with an arteriogram.
Right.
But there are these one-offs, and it gets, you know, if you roll your car, should you just get a CTA? That's what the VCU paper kind of said. Everyone that they missed with the screening criteria was in a car crash. So, you know, a motor vehicle crash is a higher mechanism, higher energy mechanism.
Like you mentioned, I think certain mechanisms of injury in terms of a big category, and then patients may have associated injuries. And then there's going to be the handful of patients that might actually have physical exam findings that are concerning for BCVI. So I kind of like to use those three big categories. On the topic of physical exam findings, one of the controversial areas that I think people get kind of confused with is patients who are in an MVC, they've got a little mark on their neck, quote unquote, seatbelt sign. Do all those patients need a CTA of the neck, or are we being a little bit overly aggressive there?
I think that the data haven't really demonstrated that the seatbelt sign is significantly associated with it. But I'll tell you, in San Diego County, they kind of they made a rule for strangulations, they should all get CTAs and things. And then the seatbelt sign kind of falls into that. And certainly if someone's rolled their car and has a seatbelt mark on their neck, yes. A lower speed crash, it's a little harder, but I think you know, as we're moving toward more liberal rather than less, I think those people are getting the CTA. It's not unreasonable.
And then on the topic of mechanism, there's the story of the young woman, Brittany Cecil, I believe, who was at an NHL game, and a hockey puck ended up hitting her and resulted in this exact mechanism that you mentioned, which was this hyperextension and potentially rotation injury that resulted in tearing of her vertebral artery. And apparently the puck was going something, these pucks go like 100 miles per hour or something crazy.
Yeah.
And I guess after that happened, they ended up putting up some nets at all the different arenas to prevent this from happening again. But unfortunate story, but I think certainly exemplifies the mechanism and what happens. Now, I guess one of the things on the topic of her eventually stroking out is that we want to be super aggressive with screening because we want to identify this injury early so that we can actually intervene to prevent stroke. And when it comes to strokes, obviously, this is a devastating complication. And in terms of timing, when do these strokes happen? Are they at risk months out, or is this something that usually happens during their acute hospitalization?
Well, it's usually in the acute hospitalization. I think about 40% of them are present at the time of admission. And then in the first 24 hours, there's another large percent. In the literature, there was one case that was 12 years after. They couldn't find anything else, but that's kind of hard to believe. And
causality,
The number of case reports on the trivial trauma, you know, stroke after visiting the hairdresser, stroke after chiropractic manipulation. Those are real things, by the way. I took care of the son of a chiropractor who was getting manipulation and had a stroke.
Oh, wow.
Not by his father, fortunately.
That's horrible.
You know, anything can happen. But, you know, back to the question, most of them are early. And so, you know, the decision to try to do preventive treatment, it is a timely one that we need to make.
And so as we learned more about BCVI, you developed some screening criteria. The evolution in terms of diagnostic imaging technology has certainly helped. And it seems like along the way, a number of different diagnostic modalities have been tested, including duplex as well as MRA. Any role for those in the modern age of CT angiography?
Yeah, so such a good question. The duplex, I work with some vascular surgeons who love duplex.
Me too.
There are no data. And in fact, I think it was the WTA multicenter study from the, you know, it's from a long time ago, but they found that duplex missed, I don't know, 14% of the patients who had had strokes. And there was a larger study, about 1,000 patients had duplex. They didn't all have carotid injuries, but they missed a lot of symptomatic lesions. So I think duplex is off the table for screening. It's user dependent. It's not easy to get. The MRA thing, this was a, you know, Denver and Memphis were publishing all these papers at the same time. And in 2002, both of us published our series of CTA and MRA.
Right.
We had a two slice scanner at the time.
Oh my goodness. That's second generation.
I don't know if Memphis had anything more advanced, but well, CTA and MRA were inadequate. And both of us stuck with arteriograms. Interesting tangent. So I moved to Rhode Island to Brown in 2002. Mm-hmm. And I got there and said, okay, we got to do these arteriograms. And the chief of interventional radiology, who's a great guy and very collaborative, he said, we're not going to do them. And I said, what are you talking about? Look at all these papers. And he said, here's our paper showing the accuracy of CTA for intracranial aneurysms. This is a good technology. We're not going to put the patients at risk. And I said, let's study it. And we published a series, kind of like a couple that came out of Texas. They were retrospective. They weren't comparative, but it was only CTA. And we didn't miss any clinical significant injuries. That's where, you know, the CTA literature started to blow up with everyone with their 16 channel and then higher scanners. We're not missing clinically significant injuries. Then you started seeing some papers. Okay, well, Harborview had this with the, you know, they had some missed injuries, but when you read it, it was maybe the radiologists weren't interpreting them.
Right.
Then in Virginia, they published one with, well, now it's too sensitive. CTA's overcalling injuries, right. And that's dangerous if you're going to treat them. So, you know, the CTA, it's gone back and forth, but Memphis was the final holdout. They've eventually published a paper saying CTA is okay if it's 64 slice. You know, there's not a body of literature supporting MRA as the most reliable screening tool, and I don't recommend it. And I, you know, when they recommend it as the, you know, adjudicating study, I still am not a fan.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I think the CT technology is still really good.
You know, one of the areas where I feel like not a lot of research has taken place is in the pediatric literature, pediatric BCVI. And I feel like in the last couple of years, there's been some papers that have come out looking at this. One of the obviously big concerns is radiating them. And as much as possible, we try to avoid CT. So are kids at risk or not?
Yeah, great question. And in fact, our colleagues at the Children's Hospital here in San Diego, we had a meeting about 3 weeks ago because they're interested in putting together a protocol and want to do a research project to try to get at it, because there are these, you know, scores, the McGovern score and things like that.
Right.
We looked, you know, years ago in Colorado with the Children's Hospital, and it seemed like, and my impression still is that with the younger kids, it's mostly direct blows, dog bites to the neck, things like that.
Yeah, toothbrush injuries.
Yes, yes. But with the adolescents, they're more like adults in terms of the mechanisms that make them susceptible. It's hard because, you know, going back years with this literature, there's the denominator is the problem. You only know in the patients who got imaging or the patients who became asymptomatic. And
right.
All these asymptomatic injuries we find with screening, you don't know. That's the argument for the universal screening, of course. But with the kids, nobody's going to do universal screening. So what are the high-risk criteria in kids? What are the ones that justify the radiation? Mm-hmm. And without denominators, you only know among the ones who were tested.
Right.
Is it every mandible fracture? Well, we don't know because certain ones were tested, but probably for a reason other than it was a mandible fracture.
Exactly.
So it's an unanswered question, and I'm not even sure how to design it other than, well, we had some ideas about doing it. I don't want to give that away before we start. Yeah. But, you know, eventually the question will have to be answered. But I do think that the younger kids are less likely to get it. So we don't need to screen everyone under 12 for sure.
Now, obviously, one of the important developments when we're talking about any injury in the trauma literature is developing some form of a grading criteria. Is that something that's been demonstrated to really be prognostic in terms of the risk for development of a stroke? And how should we be applying that criteria when it comes to management?
You know, that 1999 or 2000, we did that because, you know, working with Gene Moore, who, you know, started these, the AAST OIS scoring. Or he was, you know, on the original panel that graded all these organs. We wanted to have something that, number one, had prognostic value, but also would standardize communication. Because, right. You know, you listen and everyone will say, oh, they have a carotid dissection. Well, they're not all dissections. And not all of them have the same risk. And so, you know, a grading scale lets you get a mental image of the injury and right. Try to understand the risk. And it turns out that the risk does change with increasing grade, or at least in the data that we collected along the way. And I think it's been pretty well replicated by others and acknowledged that, you know, an occluded artery, a grade 4, there's a much higher risk of stroke than a grade 2.
Right.
The one area where I think there's some opportunity for the grading scale to be refined is among the grade 2 injuries, because when we made it, we wanted to identify one that the grade 1 injuries, is it spasm? It's a mild irregularity. It's not hemodynamically significant. We don't see an intimal flap. We, you know, but it's not a normal artery. So that was a grade 1. And for grade 2, it's where you start to be able to see a difference in the caliber. So we said 25% or more stenosis, and it's not hemodynamically significant at that range. But the point was just, it's more than just a minimal injury. But we also lumped in there, if you see clot in the artery, if you see a dissection, and those are higher risk situations than that. So, you know, I have a patient on the service right now who had, he was in a bicycle crash, and he's actually got an unusual one. It's down in the common carotid artery, and it's a long segment, what may be an intramural hematoma, either that or a dissection. It's not really clear on the CTA, but it was 40% narrowed. So it's real, and whether that's an intramural hematoma or a dissection column, it isn't clear. And yeah, the risk may be different with those. So I think refining those would be helpful to evolve the grading scale. It has held up with the increasing risk. And, you know, in the vertebral injuries, it was a little different because you can occlude one and the other one's still going to provide flow. So unless that platelets break loose and embolize,
right,
you're not going to have symptoms.
Yeah, yeah. And sort of looking at your research and body work, that's certainly what you come across with carotids. It definitely tends to be a little bit more prognostic, more so than with the vertebral artery injuries.
Yeah.
You mentioned this patient who has this common carotid artery injury. And so for many of these, especially the vertebral artery injuries, they're inaccessible. We can't get at them. And so we're going to opt for some form of antithrombotic therapy. So are there cases with blunt carotid artery injuries where we would actually operatively fix them?
Yeah, there are. And in fact, in this case, I did talk to the vascular surgeon because I said, this might be one. If it was up at the carotid siphon or the carotid canal, I wouldn't have called vascular because
right,
I don't want them mucking around up there.
Absolutely not.
But I thought, you know, where this injury is, you know, this might be something that he'd want to stent or do something else. And so I called him and he's like, well, let's just treat with dual antiplatelet therapy.
Okay.
Sure, we can talk about that more. But yeah, I think that, you know, what we had recommended and still kind of stick with this in the you know, that up-to-date algorithm is if it's a surgically accessible in the internal carotid, anything above a grade one, consider operating. The issue has always been distal control.
Right. Because
these injuries go so high that, you know, the Denver series, at, I don't know what the last one was, up to 700 some patients with injuries, one or two got surgery for it. It's just not something that you would go in and be able to get good distal control to make it worth trying to fix when the anticoagulant therapy seems to work.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's a great segue into the next topic of therapy. And certainly when we look back at the original paper by Dr. Fabian and the Memphis group looking at heparin and its ability to potentially reverse some of these ischemic neurologic deficits, things have really evolved, especially with the introduction and widespread availability and use of antiplatelet agents. And so at your shop right now, Dr. Biffle, patient comes in and let's say they've got a grade 2 injury to avert, are you putting them on anticoagulation? Are you moving right towards antiplatelet therapy? Or does their overall injury burden potentially play into which choice of therapies you're going to go with?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I continue to talk to Gene Moore and Clay Berlew about this. And, you know, we write this up-to-date chapter and they ask us for a review every year. And going back, I think it was probably in the late 90s, early 2000s, people were publishing things on treating them with aspirin. And there were really no data at the time. You know, Fabian's paper showed that there was a benefit with heparin.
Right.
And you can turn heparin off when you need to. You can reverse it. And so the you know, the papers suggesting aspirin kind of came out of the blue. And there was no, you know, they were uncontrolled, and all this literature is. Nobody's got a placebo control group for many reasons.
Right.
But over the years, there have been patients who, for one reason or another, were treated with aspirin, and retrospectively, no more of them had a stroke. We had an indication that, you know, a little blip in the statistical analysis that the progression of the injury to a higher grade was a little less with heparin versus aspirin. And so we maintain this bias that you, between those data and the fact that the heparin's reversible, kind of an arbitrary decision that if they're in the ICU, they get the heparin drip, which mm-hmm. can be reversed for surgical procedures. But once they're out, they get antiplatelet therapy. And I haven't sent anyone home on Coumadin in years.
Right.
And I don't think anyone in Denver has either.
On the topic of decision-making, and earlier you kind of mentioned you talked to one of your vascular surgeons. One of the things that I'd imagine comes up, because it's certainly come up at our hospital, is who should be involved? I mean, obviously as trauma surgeons, we like to quarterback everything and be the captain of the ship. But it seems like with BCVI, there's some overlap. We've got the potential neurologic complications and patients who might have, you know, these supraclinoid injuries, which almost seems like it belongs to the neurosurgeon. Then we've got patients with injuries to the common carotid, which kind of seems more like a vascular thing. And one of the things I've noticed is sometimes with our house staff who may not be familiar with the fact that we have guidelines for this, neurosurgery is involved, vascular is involved, sometimes the neurosurgeons call neurology, and now we're getting all these different opinions regarding what sorts of therapies, whether or not they need follow-up imaging. How have you streamlined that sort of management at your shop or your hospital, or have you?
That I will tell you, this was much easier in Denver, where, you know, we worked with our neurosurgeons and, you know, early on the interventional radiologists, and we came up with these things as a group. And so we would only talk to the neurosurgeons about the contraindications. We wouldn't necessarily talk to them about treating it. We would discuss whether, you know, is this a heparin patient or an antiplatelet patient as time went by. I'm comfortable with what's been demonstrated in the literature and what's not. So, you know, if it's me admitting the patient, I feel comfortable setting a course of treatment and follow-up and so on. Some people aren't, you right. know, in that place. And so they'll end up calling not only neurosurgery, and like you say, neurosurgery might recommend neurology, but vascular and neurointerventional radiology.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I forgot about
that. You're a hammer. Guess what they need? They need something done.
Oh boy.
You know, so that it does get a little frustrating, and getting people to feel comfortable with, yeah, you know, this is a trauma patient and they do have a spinal injury and we are going to give them an antiplatelet drug.
Right.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people want to load the boat and get someone else to write that in the chart. But once you get three different opinions, it makes it really hard to yeah. come up with a, you know, unified plan. And, mm-hmm. The literature only, they support certain things, and the rest of it is, you know, it's people's practice bias, it's fear, it's whatever influences the choice of things and how long you wait to give it a drug.
Yeah, no, very good points. And just for the listeners, I do want to remind you that we're going to have links in the show notes to the Denver grading criteria, to the Memphis and Denver criteria, as well as to the low-dose heparin protocol that's been advocated originally, I think, out of Denver. And it's certainly
we took the Memphis protocol.
You took the Memphis. All right, from Memphis to Denver to you all. And like you mentioned, Dr. Biffle, there will never be any sort of randomized placebo-controlled trial, because we know that these patients need to be treated, and not to give them any treatment seems like you're just asking for trouble. I think we don't need to get into the whole aspirin versus Plavix, but you did mention your patient last week was put on dual antiplatelet therapy. And so how does that decision get made versus monotherapy?
Well, that's a good question. And, you know, again, that was the opinion of the vascular surgeon.
Gotcha.
There aren't any data on that issue to this point. You know, as far as follow-up, I make a lot of decisions based on the second arteriogram. And we haven't talked about that, but, you know, in this case, the vascular surgeon said, we'll get a follow-up study in 30 days. First there was a duplex to look at the injury better,
right.
which basically showed what the CTA showed. But, you know, the follow-up study, depending on the risk of treatment and what the injury looks like, sometimes I'll do it pretty early, otherwise wait a week or 10 days and then decide. But the dual antiplatelet therapy, one of my other vascular colleagues brought up the point that I think is important. If you're going to give antiplatelet therapy, you should monitor the response to it, because a lot of people are non-responders. And okay. if you're giving aspirin to a non-responder, you're not really helping anything.
Okay, sure. So are you using the actual antiplatelet assays or TEG?
Yeah, antiplatelet assays.
Antiplatelet assays. Okay. Now you mentioned the role of follow-up imaging. And so is this going to differ based on the grade of the injury? And then what's the timing? You mentioned 10 days.
Yeah, so we had looked at our data, and this was back in a 2002 paper. We had been following these patients up at a week to 10 days. And back when we were using stents a little more. And so what our data showed was that at the 7 to 10 day mark, about 50 to 60% of the grade one injuries were gone. Mm-hmm. So they didn't need any more treatment. 40 to 50% of the grade two injuries were worse on that. And so either more narrowed or had developed a pseudoaneurysm. You looked for pseudoaneurysm change in size, which may be a trigger for stent placement. And so that timing we have stuck with. Now,
okay.
I like to do it earlier in certain situations, one where the original study was equivocal and people are were uncomfortable treating them. So you say, well, let's go back at 72 hours and look at it. And now, you know, the risk-benefit equation changes every day. You got a patient with a spinal injury, and now you're not so worried about epidural hematoma getting bigger. But you want to see what the injury is doing, because now if that grade 2 injury is 70% narrowed versus 30%, you say, okay, we got to bite the bullet and do something. On the other hand, if it's looking better, you might say, okay, we can wait another day. Or you use it to change decision-making. And so I'll tailor the timing a little bit to the injury and their overall risk.
Great points. I think those are really important teaching points. I think sometimes we get stuck in this sort of algorithmic or protocolized approach. And so it's 7 to 10 days, but in fact, there will be a subset of patients in whom we'll want to monitor more closely. Now, you mentioned the spinal injury, and I think one of the things that always comes up is how do we determine how to manage patients who've got a BCVI and then a TBI, or let's say a solid organ injury, or a spinal injury in which they're at a risk for epidural hematoma. So maybe starting with TBIs, what's your approach? You've got a patient with a grade 3 BCVI, but they're also coming in and they've got a subdural, maybe some subarachnoid, GCS is 14, 15, and they're in the ICU. In terms of timing, initiation, and type of therapy, how do you approach that, Dr. Biffle?
I think it's key to get the neurosurgeons involved and get something in the chart, because in that situation, you're damned if you don't. And if you do something and the bleed gets worse, then you've caused the problem. If you don't do something and they have a stroke, well, that is. So you want to evaluate that risk benefit every day. And you know, it's similar to the VTE prophylaxis issue. And you know what, we have to have a frank discussion, and that again depends on the injury grade. If it's a grade one injury, then okay, fine. If it is a grade three, then it's a little different. And so having those daily conversations about risk benefit and maybe doing early imaging in those patients is important. And I would say similar thing for the spinal injury patients. I think that a group from Stanford had published this some years ago, giving the treatment to patients with brain injury, and they showed that it was safe, just like there's some paper showing early VTE prophylaxis safe. With the solid organ injuries, I think there's enough literature saying it's safe to start some prophylactic therapy that we should. And I made that mistake early on in my career and had a patient with a splenic injury and a pelvic fracture and a grade 2 carotid injury, and said, well, I'm not going to treat them. And 12 hours later, they stroked.
Yikes.
And said, boy, I could take a spleen out, but I can't take a
Yeah.
So that's a problem.
Now, on the topic of therapies, outside of the decision between anticoagulation versus antiplatelet therapy, you've already talked a little bit about stents. And so that was one of the PICOs we had for our East PMG. And so which patients are we going to stent, and why has there been such a pushback, I guess, or hesitancy to just throw stents into patients like the cardiologists do? You know, you got a lesion in the stent, you know, you got some minor stent, double stents, dual antiplatelet therapy forever.
Well, the pushback is in the published literature, but I think in practice in many hospitals, there's a lot of enthusiasm for it. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that hammer and nail comment I made earlier that, right. We, you know, in Denver, looking at our data early on, there were some catastrophes associated with early stenting. And that was one of the reasons we said, well, number one, we got to wait a week before sticking something up in that injured artery, because it, a couple of patients had, you know, the immediate post-injury arteriography and, oh boy, let's put a stent here. And then you knock some platelets loose and,
right.
And there's a stroke. So we said, well, let's give them the anticoagulation and then go back. And, you know, if it's a certain degree of narrowing or a certain size pseudoaneurysm, put a stent in. But then we found that patients were maybe because they were non-compliant with therapy, maybe because they were non-responders for whatever reason, we had a very high stent thrombosis rate. And that was the paper that Clay Berlew wrote and said, we stopped using stents essentially, mm-hmm. Except for very extreme narrowing or very large pseudoaneurysms. Memphis continued to do them, but their last paper on the topic, they essentially had stopped and showing the same outcomes. So, you know, again, neurointerventionalists seem enthusiastic about it. And I had someone quote to me recently, well, there's a 30% chance of this rupturing. I said, in what literature? Because I'm not familiar with that. And you know, a 6 millimeter pseudoaneurysm up in a carotid siphon. And like, I haven't seen it. And you know, the same goes for embolization. People want to take an occluded vertebral artery and embolize it just in case. And there is some feeling, I think both groups from Memphis as well as Baltimore have said that these arteries recanalize and that puts the patient at higher risk for strokes. So preemptive embolization should prevent that. There's no data supporting that. It's theoretical
right
at this point. And so it's the notion that are you really benefiting the patient by putting a catheter up there? Or are you asking for more trouble? And I think that it's an area that needs controlled research, mm-hmm. because we don't have the answers to those questions, whether they can, you can't make an asymptomatic patient any better. You can potentially prevent something. And that's what we're doing with this whole thing, screening and treating.
Right.
But when you get to the interventional stuff, I think the Denver and Memphis retrospective data say that without stents, people do okay. Yeah. And so until there's a study that says with stents, they do better, I'm going to be very selective in who I refer. But again, if they get consulted on day one, there's an increased likelihood right. the patient's getting something.
I think that's a great teaching point. And certainly that's the sort of conclusion that our working group came up with, that, you know, stick with standard therapy. And certainly there will be a small subset of patients, for example, who have progression in the size of their pseudoaneurysm or become symptomatic, in whom you might consider placing a stent following multidisciplinary discussions and, of course, a risk-benefit conversation with the patient and their loved ones to go over what the potential complications are and what this means in terms of antiplatelet therapy going into the future, medication, follow-up imaging. So a lot of things to consider. They're not benign.
Yeah.
So in terms of some of the future research, when we think about BCVI, and I look over the course of where we started back in the 90s or even 80s to where we are now, I mean, we've discovered and learned so much from screening to diagnosis to therapies. So what do you see as the next big frontier when it comes to research regarding BCVI?
Determining whether universal screening is really going to be worth it is something, because there is, yeah, there's some cost involved in that, maybe more radiation, maybe if you could do it without a second dose of contrast. I think that we should hash that out. Mm-hmm. In terms of treatment, identifying the lowest risk effective treatment is important. And, you know, again, it's interesting when you start talking to the neurosurgeons, well, aspirin or heparin, and some will say, oh, go ahead and start aspirin today, but don't do heparin. And some will say the opposite. We don't really know, but figuring that out. And then, you know, the endovascular therapy, is there a role for it?
Right.
Should we embolize occluded arteries? Should we stay away from them? And the threshold for stenting, I think, you know, again, we've always wondered if there is real efficacy there. And I think some controlled studies on that.
Just to get back, I did want to ask you, so when it comes to duration of therapy, now you mentioned getting the scan at 7 to 10 days. So let's say the injury, it was a grade one and now it's resolved. At that point, do you stop the antithrombotic therapy? Okay.
Yes.
And so let's say 7, 10 days, repeat imaging, lesion is there. How do you manage that? Do you get a repeat imaging, and then do they follow up with the repeat imaging?
Well, you know, what we started with in this was bringing the patients back at 3 months and doing it again. But as time has gone on, you know, a lot of the discussions when the patient's about to leave is, well, what's the harm in keeping them on aspirin and tell them to take it for a year and or until they forget to start to keep taking it? Right. Is there any harm in that? Probably not. And so I think it's fewer patients who are actually coming back for 3 month imaging. I think it's important in a patient with a, you know, 7 millimeter pseudoaneurysm, they should probably come back for imaging, or someone who had a significant narrowing, you know, grade two injury with that. But, you know, a patient with an occluded vertebral artery whose symptoms haven't changed, who were always asymptomatic, do they need more imaging or can they just take aspirin? I think that we don't really know the answer to that, but I am inclined in more patients to just say, take an aspirin every day.
And sure. And please tell me that you agree with this statement that NOACs and DOACs are probably going to be overkill in these patients.
Well, probably, given that antiplatelet therapy seems to be good long-term treatment. Yeah, nobody has studied the DOACs, and we'll see if that starts to emerge.
Sounds good. So as we wrap up, Dr. Biffle, any key teaching points or take-home messages, clinical pearls we should leave for our listeners?
Well, I would say, number one, don't miss the high-risk patients for screening. You know, someone goes over the handlebars and smashes their face, I think they should get it. And then, you know, when there's risk, get the right people involved to evaluate. We don't want, again, 3 to 5 opinions isn't helpful, but getting, you know, if you're going to anticoagulate a patient with a brain bleed, best to get a second opinion supporting that.
Well, listen, Walt, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to meet with us and talk. I know we've been planning on doing this from even before the AAST meeting. So it's great to see you. Always learned so much from you. And thank you so much.
Well, thanks, Dennis, and we'll see you later.
Well, that wraps up another episode of Rounds. If you like what you're hearing, or you find the content even remotely helpful to you in your clinical practice, please share and let us know. You can leave a positive comment and 5-star rating on iTunes or Stitcher, and be sure to subscribe to the show and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues. Until next time, wear your masks, wash your hands, keep reading, and please do take care of yourselves and one another.